Live from the west coast of Canada, this is the SWL Digest 2025, featuring Ian McFarlane, formerly of Radio Canada International, CBC, BBC London, and yours truly, Colin Newell of DXer.ca. Welcome to the Shortwave Listener's Digest, Episode 1, 2025.
You're tuned to the African service of Radio Canada International. And a very good evening to you from me, Ian McFarlane, and welcome now to the first edition of the Shortwave Listener's Digest for 1982.
Hey, it's been quite a long time since we've heard that bit of music on the shortwave bands, and shortwave listeners with very good memories will identify that theme with a particular program and the host of that program heard on Radio Canada International, RCI, for many years. My name's Colin Newell, and I've been in SWL for more than 50 years. I started listening to Ian McFarlane when I was 14, and right now he's sitting across the microphone from me as we take a walk down Nostalgia Lane. It's hard to believe, Ian, that's been 36 years since the decimation of RCI back in March of 1981 and the disappearance of the SWL Digest from shortwave.
Yeah, it sure is hard to believe, Colin. It was that event that eventually led to the total windup of RCI on shortwave some years later, and the dismantling of the transmitter plant and the antenna farm in Sackville, New Brunswick, on Canada's east coast.
Now, I don't think anybody could argue with the fact that you're a successful international broadcaster, but what, in effect, was the bottom rung of your ladder to success?
Well, it was a rather tall ladder, actually. And it took me roughly 10 years to climb it from bottom to top. And that bottom rung was a four-year course in electronics at MIT. No, I hasten to add, not the famous MIT in the US, but rather the Montreal Institute of Technology.
So what was the next step in your journey?
Well, in between years 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, I worked at the CBC in Montreal as a summer relief technician. First in TV and then in radio as a studio technician. And after graduation, I started applying on a monthly basis for a job, for a permanent job as a radio studio technician. And the first 3 applications were in English, being a staunch Anglophone in Quebec, and no luck on those applications. And the next one was in French. As you say, if you can't beat them, join them. And since the technical department was largely a French language operation.
Now, did that change your luck at all?
It sure did. Around 10 o'clock on a Friday evening, I got the surprise of my young life. At 10 p.m. on that Friday evening, I got a phone call from the head of the radio technical department offering me a temporary position to replace a technician who had badly injured his back in a fall on a remote broadcast. Fortunately, the job became permanent a few months later, and I was on my way. After about 3.5 years working mostly swing shifts, either early in the morning, opening up the station, or late at night, closing down the station at 1:15 in the morning. And at the same time, I was working from time to time in a semi-professional theater group. I took a very big step on that one. My ultimate aim was to become a producer in the International Service, or IS for short. I had really had enough of swing shifts, I can tell you.
So what was your final remedy for the swing shifts?
Well, the solution was a bit drastic. I decided that the only way I was going to achieve that ultimate game of mine was to get some experience working for an organization like the BBC, the grand old lady of the BBC. So I applied to the BBC and arranged to have an interview on a certain date in London. So my wife and I put our furniture in storage, sublet our apartment, quit our jobs, and booked our passage on a ship to England and hoped for the best.
Your wife Mary was from England, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. And at least since she was born in England and her parents still were alive and lived there, We had a place to stay with her parents, who lived in Surrey. Long story short, the BBC didn't work out, and while I was looking for a job in perhaps the recording or film industries, I worked in a grocery warehouse loading trucks. The problem with those two lines of work, that's film and recording, is that you can't get a job without being in the union. And you can't get into the union unless, well, yep. You know the story. Yep. A dead end. So a few months later, and many tons of loaded groceries, I paid a visit to the CBC London Bureau and had a long chat with the head of the bureau. And that chat, led by sheer good luck and happenstance, that led to a job in the bureau as a production assistant. In retrospect, that job turned out to be the best journeyman's education in broadcasting that I could possibly have had.
So what sort of things did you do in CBC London?
Well, since I had a technical background as a studio technician in Montreal, I did all the technical work. Actually, I set up a small studio. They didn't have a proper studio. And I did radio research, television research, recorded reports by the correspondents that worked in the London Bureau. And one day, one of the reporters had to do some what we call streeters, interviews in the street. And he had a cameraman, but he had no sound man. So since I had the technical background, I went out and did my thing as the sound man to the cameraman. And that worked out quite well. And that's about it. But as I say, it was really a journeyman's education in broadcasting, because there were no unions to worry about, so I could do virtually everything, and the liaison with the BBC as well in the technical end of things.
Now, you were in London in 1965, and I would imagine that you would have had some interesting events that year. It was an incredible year with the Beatles, etc. Was there any momentous events during your London stint?
Well, the most memorable and momentous event was the death of Sir Winston Churchill. And that was in January of 1965. The London Bureau was a very busy place for over a week, preparing for the CBC coverage of the funeral back in Canada. And we were so busy, I didn't get to go home for 9 days.
And how long were you in London?
Well, altogether, it was 3.5 very enjoyable years. And at the CBC in Montreal, where I worked prior to moving to England and working in the London Bureau, we edited the audio tape with an implement called an Allonge tape splicer. It was quite laborious to use, and it took quite a few individual operations to complete a splice. In London, there was no sign of the Allonge, thank goodness. Mm. What they did was they used an aluminum splicing block made by EMI, which was far more efficient and easy to use. The only other part of doing a splice was a razor blade. So I put together a comparative report, complete with photos, bundled it up with a couple of EMA blocks, and sent it to the head of the radio technical department at CBC Montreal. I don't recall getting any feedback on my efforts, but when I was back in Montreal on holiday about a year later, I dropped by the CBC and, wouldn't you know it, nicely mounted on the head cover of all the Ampex tape machines was a nice, shiny EMI tape editing block. One triumph for McFarland.
Yeah, I've actually seen those at various studios in Western Canada.
Yeah.
So when did your move back to Canada take place?
Well, it was in London. Somewhat ironically, I was actually working for the BBC, but permanently seconded to the CBC London Bureau. And the only way I could get back into CBC was to go back into my old job as a technician in the radio department. Now, fortunately, there was an opening. Thank goodness for that. Then I started applying for every producer opening in the international service. And within 3 months, I was a producer, or so I thought.
What happened?
Well, there was a goodbye party laid on in the technical department, and on the very day that the party was due to take place, the CBC had one of its fairly regular freezes. There were no transfers, there were no hirings, no firings, no layoffs, no nothing. So my my party didn't quite happen. But 3 months later, the freeze was over, and I moved up into the international service.
And that sounds like it might bring us kind of nicely to the start of your very popular DX program.
Yeah, it does indeed, Colin. First of all, though, I should mention another very popular program that was heard on the international service for many, many years. And that was the ancestor of the SWL Digest, and it was the Radio Canada Shortwave Club. It was very popular indeed, hosted by Pip Duke and Duncan Nicholson, the head and deputy head of the engineering department of international service, and Elaine Master from the audience relations department was the club secretary. Unfortunately, I just can't remember the year when the Digest began as a 5-minute feature on the weekend. And it sort of grew like Jack's Beanstalk. At first, I did what I was asked for. I did a little five-minute feature, and that went on for a couple of weeks. And a little later, I made it 6 minutes, and then nobody barked. Hang on there, McFarlane. And I brought it up to 7 minutes, and eventually it was about 10 minutes long. And eventually it morphed into a regular feature, and it was about 21 minutes long. And it went into all of the transmissions that we did on the weekends.
Yeah, I remember this quite well, actually. You had a number of regular features on the program over the years, but you also did a number of co-productions with the host of the DX program on Swiss Radio International, the Swiss Shortwave Merry-Go-Round.
Yes, Bob Zanotti and I have been very good friends and broadcasting colleagues since we first met at the EDXE conference in Malmo, Sweden. That was back in 1974. Welcome to our podcast, Bob.
Well, good morning and good evening from here as we speak. It's just a few minutes before 8 p.m. and the fantastic technology that we have here. You could be right here in the room with me. And the quality is absolutely superb, as we say in ham radio, 5.9 plus.
Wow. Yeah. Well, Bob, it's really like old times having you as a guest here on SWL Digest 2025.
Well, thank you very much. And you and I have a long history of knowing each other, working with each other. We had joint programs together, and I'm sure we're going to get into that.
I think we will. Well, actually, you and I met, I think, if my memory serves, met in 1974 at the EDXE conference in Malmo, Sweden.
That could well be. I can't swear to it, but I'll take your word for it. It sounds about right.
I still have a photograph of you and I sitting in a picnic bench working with our individual tape recorders.
I know, and we both had long hair at the time, and a lot more than we do now. And I believe you had a beard at the time as well,
quite a substantial one. Yeah, I've had the beard since 1967.
Okay,
it was my centennial gesture.
That reminds me, you talk about Malmö, to pronounce it in the Swedish way. I also worked for Radio Sweden in Stockholm. I was there for about a year and a half for a stint with them. And I actually presented their DX program, Sweden Calling DXers. And I knew Arne Skog, who was the grand old man of DXing in Sweden. Yeah. And I know that Scandinavia at the time had a tremendous reputation for DXing and SWLing. And there's been speculation why that should be, and I think I can answer that question twofold. Number one, they are so out of it in terms of the continent. They're really offsides, to use a soccer term. And beside that, also, the nights are long and very cold and absolutely perfect for DXing. I can remember being in my room there, outside Stockholm in a place called Danderyd, and looking out the window, and minus 18, minus 20 degrees, and dark, you know, in the wintertime there, there is no light. There's gray for about an hour and a half in the afternoon, and everything goes black. So you have to think of something to do. There are one or two things that we will skip here, but one of them could be DXing and hunting for distant radio stations. Great place for that.
Yeah, they did a lot of over-the-pole medium wave DXing too.
I did it too up there, and you know, I could receive it even on an ordinary Schaublerenz portable radio.
Well, we took advantage of both being in the same place at the same time at EDXC conferences and also a few big exhibitions, the one in Berlin in 1989, I think that was, and also a big ITU conference. Well, it was actually a big show of equipment, software, hardware that was in Geneva, if I remember correctly.
And you do. Yes, that's right. That was Telecom
83. Yeah.
Right. And ITU, by the way, is the International Telecommunication Union, a UN specialized agency, which coordinates, arranges, and sets guidelines and regulations for international telecommunications. Without them, you and I could not be sitting here talking over Zoom right now. And there would be no shortwave and no broadcasting of any kind. At least it would be chaotic, to say the least, without them.
Yeah. Well, we did quite a lot of joint coverage. I took every chance I could possibly get to go to Europe and attend an EDXC conference. And we did, I think, did joint coverage on each of our programs on all of the conferences that we both went to.
Yes, we had a very good cooperation. And by the way, I think I can say that you and I really hit it off well from the start. We just were good friends from the very beginning, from the first moment. And there's also that we should mention this. At one time, there was the so-called, it started off as the group of four, and those of us called it, you know, we called it informally the Gang of Four, yes. Spin-off from the Chinese gang, you know, remember though, way back when, Mao Zedong and everything. Yeah. And it was Radio Canada International, Swiss Radio International, Radio Sweden, and Radio Netherlands.
Right.
And we had a lot of cooperation. Our management met regularly, and they promoted and encouraged cooperation. And really, to be honest, Ian, I think you had the idea. You started the ball rolling there. And you said, hey, why don't we do something together? And my memory serves, you and I were the only ones who really cooperated on that level. And we did a lot of stuff together. And if I'm not mistaken, once or twice, there was a strike at RCI, and you weren't even going to be on the air because there were no technicians or something. And we broadcast the RCI portion on SRI as well. I may be wrong. Do you remember that?
That's a bit fuzzy in my memory, but I know there was a strike at one point when I was out of the country, which was lucky for me because I didn't have to cross a picket line or anything like that. So it worked out well.
You mentioned also that I was going to say fiasco. And actually, it was. It was, what was it billed as? The International Broadcasters Conference in Berlin. And it was organized, or perhaps disorganized, by our friend, our late friend, David Monson.
Yeah, that was International Broadcasting Days, I think it was called.
Days, that's it. Yeah. That's it. International Broadcasting Days. And he promised us the world with a ribbon around it. And in the end, it turned out to be in some obscure place. It was not publicized. Nobody turned up. And you and I really tried to do the best we could and make the best of it. We went back to Bern, and we did that was a joint program that we did. I remember you and I down in the basement studio. It was not very popular with many people, but you and I had a great time down there, the basement cutting room. And we got down there with our tons of recorded material done, I believe, on our Sony Pro cassette machines. And I went down the street to the co-op supermarket, got a couple of frozen pizzas and a bottle or two of red wine. And we did both justice, not to mention the program, and it came out very well. Yeah, we have a lot of memories of our joint programs there. Yep. And also, we had to come up with a pretty good, solid excuse to explain why the Berlin event was actually a failure. We coordinated on that, and our managements accepted our reasoning. And basically, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but let's just say it was horribly disorganized and went completely off the rails.
Well, as far as you and I were concerned, the old saying occurs to me, when life dishes out lemons, you make lemonade. And we made a lot of lemonade on those joint productions.
Well, yeah, and you know, another old expression, making a silk purse out of a sow's ear. That does not cover the other stuff we did, but certainly we really did the best job we could in covering the Berlin event, because there was really nobody there to interview. I don't remember anybody coming by to interview. We basically interviewed ourselves and maybe one or two other disgruntled colleagues from other stations who shook their heads the same way we did. And, well, that's water under the bridge, and I'll never forget it. And I don't think, you know, the audience really minded that much, because we did a good cover job there.
Yeah.
And I think we showed ourselves as professionals who made the best out of a bad deal.
We certainly did. And I'd like to thank you, Bob, for all those great memories that we both have and in our over 40-year friendship now.
And I can't forget one thing I have to add as a footnote, speaking of conferences and getting together, SRI organized a European DX Council conference in Bern some years ago, and you stayed with us here. Here in the Emmental, we had a wonderful time. And we did some joint programming there as well. That was, I think, back in the late 80s or maybe the early 90s. I honestly can't tell you.
Yeah, well.
But it was fun. That I can tell you.
Yeah, I keep hammering away at myself that I didn't keep a journal, because I did a, I guess you'd call it a broadcasting memoir, basically for my kids, so that they knew what their old man did for a living. And it's full of, I can't remember the year, but because I didn't keep a journal, so it was all memory, and my memory started to fade quite a few years ago.
Well, that happens to all of us. I recall what Albert Einstein was once said to have, or said once, or said to have said, never commit anything to memory. Don't clutter your brain with information. Write it down. And Cullen and Ian, with your permission, we've been talking about these joint programs. I would really like to call attention to my website. Once again, Switzerland in Sound, switzerlandinsound.com. And there's a section there devoted to the two Bobs, Bob Thoman and I. And we have some what survived of the old two Bobs or merry-go-round shows. We have an interview that Bob and I did with you, Ian, for the website. And if you look under Vintage Two Bobs, you will find several of the joint programs that we have been discussing here today. Switzerlandinsound.com.
Wow, thank you, Bob. That's really helpful.
Thank you.
It's been great going over all those good memories.
At some point, as I recall, you changed the name of the program from the DX Digest to the SWL Digest. What was the reason for that?
Well, I think it gave it a very specific target area as far as listeners were concerned, to call it the DX Digest. And I knew that all shortwave listeners weren't dyed-in-the-wool DXers, so in an attempt to include all types of listeners in the name of the program, I changed it to the Shortwave Listener's Digest.
Wow, of course. And over the years of the DX program, you were able to do quite a bit of traveling. You mentioned the EDXC conference above. You must have met quite a few listeners in different parts of the world.
Yes, I had listeners in just about every continent there is, and I was very fortunate indeed to be able to meet a lot more listeners than all of my RCI colleagues put together, I think. I attended EDXC Council conferences and DX parliaments in Paris, in Malmo, Sweden, Cambridge in England, and Paris. And I also attended many annual conventions of ANARC, the Association of North American Radio Clubs, in various parts of the U.S. and Canada. I also organized three of the ANARC conventions in Montreal. So in all that travel, I had the enjoyable opportunity to meet many, many hundreds of listeners. And one of the questions that I've been asked many times by listeners is, what is the average listener like? Well, to be truthful here, there isn't really an average listener. There are doctors, lawyers, teachers, university professors, journalists, truck drivers, and just plain folks, as you might say. And one of the journalists whose reports that I fed back to Montreal each week when I worked in London told me that one time when he was in Nairobi, Kenya, he was in a taxi and got to talking with the driver. And at one point in the conversation, the driver said, "Aren't you Patrick Heatley?" Patrick replied, "Yes, I am. How did you know?" And the driver replied, "I listened to your reports on the BBC shortwave." Is he an average listener? Who knows? One of my regular listeners was a university philosophy professor in Montreal, and he dropped by my office for a chat from time to time, and it was most enjoyable.
Wow. Well, I can't think of better examples to demonstrate what a wide cross-section of humanity listened to shortwave in the heyday of this communications medium.
You've been listening to Episode 1 of the SWL Digest 2025, featuring Ian McFarland, formerly of Radio Canada International, and Bob Zanotti of Swiss Radio International. Join us soon for Episode 2 of the Shortwave Listener's Digest 2025. Я предполагаю, что это сделано для меня, чтобы я